It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. 3 weeks from tonight, on Friday, October 16th, Peter Frampton brings his acoustic tour to the Carnegie Music Hall of Homestead in Munhall. It's sure to be a different sort of evening for Frampton fans, especially those for whom the classic rock album Frampton Comes Alive was the soundtrack of the summer of 76, and you know who you are. Mr. Frampton has continued to come up with new ways to present his sound, including his latest album of original guitar pieces inspired by the Cincinnati Ballet called Hummingbird in a Box, which we'll get to. Peter Frampton is a Grammy Award winner and former Billboard and Rolling Stone magazine Artist of the Year. He joins us by phone. Peter Frampton, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Very nice to be with you.
And if you'd like to join the conversation, 412-246-2002, the number to call. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh at wesa.fm, on Twitter at esspgh. If there's something you've always wanted to ask Peter Frampton, now's your chance. 412-246-2002. You're calling this Peter Frampton Raw, an acoustic tour. What can you tell us about it, Peter?
Well, basically, it's something that I've never done before, and I'm in the process of doing an album of just me and acoustic guitar, doing my older material just the way I wrote it, like 2 seconds after I finished the song. And you, Paul, came by, and I said, hey, sit down, Paul. I just want to play you this song I just finished, and I play you Show Me the Way or something. And that's the way I'm recording this album, with that sort of emotion, not like it's on stage. Well, this performance that we're going to do is basically the same. There'll be a lot more songs, obviously, than will be on the CD, but I plan on doing this more than once. This is sort of just a 12-date test for me to see how it goes, and as I've never done it before. So it's basically, to start with, it'll be me coming out and doing 4 or 5 songs on acoustic alone, and then my writing partner of many years, Gordon Kennedy, will come out and join me on acoustic as well, not an electric instrument on the stage. And we'll just be going through some material from my entire career, stuff that I've never done live as a solo artist, from Humble Pie, acoustic numbers, songs that I'm doing acoustically from earlier albums, and also from the latest Hummingbird in a Box. So it's going to span the whole thing. It's just, and I did put out a post the media there that I wanted to see what people were requesting, and so I've taken all that into consideration too. I got a slew of requests of songs that some I had chosen already, and some I thought, well, that's a good idea. So it works. So that's what we'll be doing.
And this could be. It makes me think about Eric Clapton, because when he did that acoustic version of Layla, that really blew people's minds in a good way, because it was so different from, you know, the way we were used to hearing that song. And I imagine that's going to be the same for the type of things you're doing.
Well, it has to change, yes, because that was doing Layla was a completely different, for Eric was a completely different time signature and everything, which was great. We'll be doing these numbers in a way that will be different. It's just going to be interesting to me to see the reaction to these. I feel from what, seeing as these two projects are sort of wrapped up in one, really, for me, recording a CD, which I'm almost done with, when I would just invite a couple of friends to hear a couple of tracks, their response basically to, including my children, actually, always a good test bed. And the general consensus is that it pulls you in more. You generally, there's less going on in the song to take away from the lyrical content, and generally pulls you in to the story of the song a little bit more, obviously. So that's a good, that's the way I see it.
Can you tell us a song, Peter, that the audience selected that surprised you?
Let's see. Well, I know that Take Me Back is one that was on the second Humble Pie album, and a lot of people have requested that, and a lot of people are going to be pleased. So, and in fact, I think that one, I'm going to actually sing that with my son, Julian. We're both going to sing that one. So it'll be a lot of fun to switch off vocals on that one.
Right. I was going to mention that you're bringing a special guest along on this tour, your son, singer and guitarist Julian Frampton. What can you tell us about him and the kind of performer that he is?
Well, he's obviously very special to me. I'm biased.
Why not?
He's a great writer, lyricist, songwriter, guitar player, and he's just sort of starting out, playing out. And he did a recording with me on the last, the one before Hummingbird, on the Mr. Churchill album, and Road to the Sun. And we'll be doing that acoustically, but it's a very heavy rock number on that album. But yeah, well, that's when we first started writing together, and a few years of 4 or 5 years ago, and I've just he's got the bug and he wants to get out there. So this seems the perfect. He's played with us live before with the band, but then I thought this would be a perfect forum for him to come out, open for us, and then come out and play a couple of numbers with us too. So with myself and Gordon, my writing partner.
We're talking with Peter Frampton here on Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and our phone number 412-246-2002. Let's go to Bob in Monroeville, who has a question. Hi, Bob. You're on with Peter Frampton.
Thank you, Paul. Hello, Peter.
Hi there.
Peter, out in Cincinnati, aren't you running a music school or something out there from what I heard?
No, that's probably a rumor. I wish I was, and I wish I could. maybe that's something to put on the on my agenda. But no, I'm no longer. Even though Cincinnati will always be a home to me, I'm now in Nashville, Tennessee, and this is my home now. But I'll always be a Cincinnati person.
What sort of formal training did you have, Peter, when you first started? I mean, when you were younger, did you have formal guitar training or anything?
I started off teaching myself, as they say, playing by ear, and that got a little painful. So I decided to get my parents said, look, you're obsessed with this. So when I was 12 years old, they sent me to classical guitar lessons, which I hated at the time, and now really am thrilled that I went to.
Thank you very much, Bob. Peter, you mentioned the picking up the guitar. You've been described as a prodigy. Is that an oversimplification of your ability when you first picked up the guitar?
I don't know. Those are words for other people to use, as you say. But I definitely, as soon as I picked up a guitar when I was, I was a banjo-shaped ukulele to start with four strings for my little hands. And then at that time when I was seven, and then a year later when I was eight, Santa Claus bought me a guitar. Dad, thank you. and I became pretty obsessed with playing the guitar from then on, and became pretty good pretty quick. And so whatever that is, it's a gift that I feel I was born with, and very thankful for that, obviously. And I was drawn to it. I just became obsessed with other guitar sounds and emulating all these wonderful guitar players at a very early age, and was able to do it without, I think, because I was able to pick it up by ear. I had no tape recorder. You can't slow guitar solos down and listen to them over and over and over again. Slow when you're, in those days, there wasn't the technology, but I would pick stuff up very, very quickly. So I just, whatever that is, that's what I was.
Let's go to Tom in Butler. Hi, Tom. You're on with Peter Frampton.
Peter, I want to say it's a great honor and pleasure to speak with you and hear you on the radio in Pittsburgh today. I was wondering if you would briefly share the story of your Les Paul that you lost in an airplane crash and miraculously recovered decades later with the listeners, because it is an incredible story. If you can just tell that story briefly, I'd appreciate it. Thank you very much, and I look forward
to seeing
you.
Thank you. Yes, it's one of those fairy stories that, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. So in 1980, as you said, you're correct, a cargo plane went down in Caracas, Venezuela, with all our equipment on. And luckily, we weren't there, but of course, other people were not so lucky that were flying the plane. So it sort of put everything in perspective at the time. But yes, all our equipment went. And when I sent someone down there a week later, when the fire was out, because it was a major explosion on the runway there, and when they went down, they asked, you know, did anything make it? And they said no. Well, that was not a true story. What we then learned 30 years later is the tail broke off, and in the tail were all the guitars, and they were supposedly being guarded as well as all the other debris for the insurance company and everything. But the guard apparently decided that he thought the guitars would be much better looked after at home. And then he decided maybe he'd sell them. So we didn't know this, though. We thought that all the guitars, we were told, they were all went back to the earth. They were all cinders. And so 30 years later, I open an email from my website, Contact Peter. It does work. And I see all those, and there, with a big shriek, as I saw the pictures, about a dozen forensically taken shots of the guitar, you know, at that point, 30 years later. And I couldn't believe it. And then it took a couple of years of a gray area, we'll say, as to how to get it back, because everyone that was saying they'd get it back to me was worried that I was going to arrest them for stolen property. But that wasn't the issue at all. So I just wanted to get the thing back and thank them, whoever found it. So I don't know the entire story there of where it's what it did for 30 years, if it could only speak. But then I had them finally fly to Nashville with the guitar, and I filmed the whole thing, and it's actually on a little extra on a DVD from the Frampton Comes Alive 35 collection of from the moment the guy walked in the door with the guitar till it ended up on stage being played at the Beacon Theater in New York. So it's an unbelievable story.
Yeah, incredible. Thanks for that question, Tom. Peter, of course, you were in bands like The Herd and Humble Pie and eventually went solo. And in 1975, you recorded songs in concert at the Winterland Ballroom in San Francisco that eventually became Frampton Comes Alive. Mm-hmm. Was it your intent to record a live album all along, or was someone rolling tape and the energy was so good that you decided, hey, we have the basis for a great live album here?
It was actually a planned thing. It came out of the template of my time with Humble Pie, because we had released, I think, about four studio records, and our audience response was far greater than our record sales, because Humble Pie was a very live band, and word of mouth travels fast when there's a good live band. And We had tried for our fifth record. We decided that we would do a live record, which was agreed upon by management and the record company, which became Rock in the Fillmore, which we recorded at the Fillmore East. And that became Humble Pie's first successful album. It was a gold record. And soon after that, I left. And then started at the bottom again as a solo artist. And again, on my fifth record, four studio records, then the fifth album, we decided, well, should we do the same thing? And everyone just nodded, and it was sort of understood that that's what we would do, you know. It worked before, let's try it again. And so we did, and decided that San Francisco was going to be our very first headline date in San Francisco. San Francisco, Detroit, New York were three markets that seemed to be, we could play slightly bigger venues there than anywhere else. So we decided on either one of those. And it worked out that San Francisco was the right place to do it. right time, and we did it there, and came off stage, and it was one of those nights when you hope that you look at all the other band members and you hope they're all smiling and saying, I had a great night, you know, and we did. It was one of those very, the occasion of being the first headline date in the Bay Area was a much greater event than us recording it. So we weren't even thinking about recording it, even though we knew the truck was outside. So I think it transcended, oh dear, we're recording tonight, into, oh, this is amazing. Look at this response from our first, you know, official headline show. And that's why I think it was such a wonderful night, and we captured it.
Frampton Comes Alive spent 10 weeks at the top of the Billboard charts in 1976. It sold 6 million copies to become the biggest-selling live album. 40 years later, it's still the fourth biggest. It's been certified as 6 times platinum. When you were...
I have to correct you there. Worldwide, it has now sold 17 million.
17 million?
Yes.
Man.
And it was in that time when you said it was 6 times platinum, it was 7 million at the time. So, hey, I like figures occasionally.
I don't mind that at all. So, you know, the point being, and what I'm leading up to asking you is, when, you know, did you have any idea that this album was going to be as big as it was?
Not a clue, no. I mean, we thought along the lines of the template of Humble Pie that we were following that this would be a gold record, 500,000 copies. And of course it did that in the first week, which just took everyone by the business by surprise. I think, no one knew that was going to happen. And, obviously all the work that we had done, supporting all these, big acts over the previous 5 years, and my time with Humble Pie, word of mouth is very strong. So even though I might not have been on the radio before Comes Alive that much everywhere, the word of mouth was out there that this was the album to get because they'd seen the show and they wanted to get it. So I think that it's a real good and we're sort of back to word of mouth now, but on the internet. And I think that it's very, very, well, it is incredibly powerful. The public know what they want when they find it, you know.
Well, the album produced the hit songs Baby, I Love Your Way, Show Me the Way, Do You Feel Like We Do? And the latter two tracks famously featured your use of the talk box guitar effect. And, Peter, I want to play a clip from Do You Feel Like We Do? And then have you talk about it.
Okay.
Let's listen. So, Peter, what inspired you to incorporate the talk box guitar effect into your sound? Because it really became part of your signature sound.
Yes. Well, it all goes back to when I was listening to Under the Covers late at night, when I was supposed to not be listening to any more music. My parents had turned the lights out and pulled the plug. But I was listening to a show from Luxembourg in England. Luxembourg in Europe was broadcasting, and we could pick it up in England. And through headphones under the covers, I was listening to this great American and British music that we couldn't hear in England because we only had the BBC, one station at that time. And so their call letters or their numbers on the AM dial was 208. And they used to do this sound, radio 208, with that talk boxy computerish sound. So I'd heard that all my life. You know, I would always think about that. And then I would hear computer-esque type sounds way before computers, obviously. And then, lo and behold, I was asked by George Harrison to play on All Things Must Pass album on acoustic. And during my the sessions there, at Abbey Road in London. George brought over Pete Drake from Nashville, where I currently I now live, my home. And Bob Dylan had recommended Pete Drake, I think, to George because Pete had played on Nashville Skyline, Bob's big album. And so there we have Pete Drake, nicest guy in the world. Everybody instantly loved him, and what a great player he was. And in a slow moment, he just got out this little black box, and it had a plastic pipe, and he plugged something in somewhere and put this pipe in his mouth, and all of a sudden, the pedal steel was talking to me and singing to me in that fabulous two-way, that sound that I'd heard when I was very, very young. And I was speechless because this, I said, there it is. And he said, what do you mean? I said, oh, it's the sound I've heard in my head for so long. And then I got the history of Pete Drake, and he'd had radio hits in the 60s called I Am the Guitar. And had been on big TV shows in America and stuff. So it was known here. And so then I went off and tried to find one, which I did. Bob Heil of Heil Sound, who now makes microphones, great microphones, dear friend of his. And he made me one, and also Joe Walsh one at the same time. So, yeah, and that's where the idea came. And then I locked myself away for a few days and learned how to talk with this thing, because Joe was using it in a, Joe Walsh on Rocky Mountain Way was using it in a, just a sound, using the sound of it created by the shape of your mouth, you know, with the pipe. And for me, the idea was to, like, Pete Drake was to talk with it and to sing with it and to communicate with the audience, which I thought would be funny. And it turned out it was. So that's how we chose Do You Feel first, because there was a very free part at the end of the song. And I don't remember exactly when I first brought it into that song, but I remember the first time we did it, the audience went nuts, you know, because they didn't know what it was. And
no, nobody did.
No.
I remember driving.
But now with the advent of auto-tune, everybody knows what it is. But that's all computerized. The talk box is very analog, and it's all down to, you know, the guitar sound and the shape of the pipe and the shape of your mouth and how many false teeth you got.
Peter Frampton is our guest here on Essential Pittsburgh. Peter, do you have time to take one more phone call?
Absolutely.
All right. We've got Lily from North Hills on the line. Lily, go ahead with your question for Peter Frampton.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, Lily.
I would like to know what combination of factors you think made the Frampton Comes Alive album just explode on the scene and made it such a success.
Good question. I used to say I've no idea, but I think that all my life I've been, my happiest moments are on stage in front of people, communicating through music and my playing and my singing, but mostly my playing in some, there's a communication I have with that I don't even have with my singing. And I think that the initial sale of the rush to buy it was because it was, as I said earlier, the act that people had been watching over the last 18 months, 2 years before it was released, and they liked it and they wanted to buy that show. But I think what sent it over the top was there's that it factor, which I hate using that, but there's something in there that when you listen to that record, you actually smile because you can feel that we are enjoying what we're doing, and it comes across, and that's indefinable. I don't know what you call it. I don't know what it is, but it definitely comes across when you listen to that record. And like I said, you know, that's it. And I don't know what you call it, but it's definitely in there.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you were co-headlining a tour with Cheap Trick this summer, and the same thing happened to them. And it's hard to describe how or why it happens, but it's just an energy that's there, and it's unmistakable, no doubt about that.
And playing with Cheap Trick, which was phenomenal. This year, this whole year, the summer was great. you know, as Rick said, it's very live. The show is we are live players, you know. And like you said, their biggest, their first success was from Live in Budokan, and amazing record, and had that vibe in it too. And so the combination of the two of us, I think it's one of the best. We've played with some amazing acts, and we love playing and combining the show with so many different people. It's always a thrill. But I think the fact that both of us were known and came to be known through live records on a mass scale, I think that says a lot about how good the show's going to be. And it was very true. I think nobody went away disappointed, and it was just a great tour to do.
Peter, very quickly, because we're pressed for time, and we know you are too, I did want to mention Hummingbird in a Box, your most recent album. It's songs for a ballet, which was inspired by the Cincinnati Ballet. What was it like writing for dance?
Well, I've never written for dance, so it was kind of challenging and kind of, well, let's see if this works. I basically spoke to Adam Hoagland, the choreographer of our 20-minute piece of the new music. And I said, what do you need? And he said, well, give me a beginning, a middle, and an end. So that was the only direction I got, basically. And it was just realizing that there was no rules. There's never any rules with writing music anyway. They're all to be broken. And it didn't matter whether it was half instrumental, half vocal, or all instrumental, or it ended in a different key than it started in. It was just very open and freeing to write for that. And we just hoped it worked for them. And when we performed it with Cincinnati Ballet in Cincinnati for the three nights, it went over so well. It was wonderful.
Well, you've given us a great beginning, middle, and end, Peter. Peter Frampton has been our guest. He's bringing Peter Frampton Raw, an acoustic tour, to the Carnegie Music Hall of Homestead in Munn Hall 3 weeks from today, October 16th. Peter Frampton, thanks for being so generous with your time and joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Wonderful, and I can't wait to play the music hall. It looks phenomenal. I looked it up this morning. It's a beautiful building.
Looking forward to seeing you.
All right, same here.
Coming up, what will happen when Ask Me and Others' Ophira Eisenberg and Jonathan Colton put Margaret J. Krause and I in the hot seat? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.
Ooh, baby, I love you, Wayne. Wanna tell you I love you.